From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour came in the form of a surprise announcement from Hobart and William Smith Colleges. The president of the colleges, President Joyce Jacobson, announced that she will step down as president. Following a one-semester sabbatical, Jacobson will join the faculty as a professor of economics. And the former college's president, Mark Guerin, is coming back to take the same job. I'll refer now to reporting by my colleagues at WEOS and WXXI. Soon after Jacobson's announcement, there was an email sent from the Hobart and William Smith College's Board of Trustees. The co-chairs announced that Professor Emeritus of the College's Mark Guerin will return as now the 30th president of HWS, the 19th president of William Smith. Jacobson joined Hobart and William Smith as president in 2019. It was just about a three-year stint. And Guerin had served for 18 years as president of the colleges, leaving in 2017. He had departed to serve as president in residence at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, and in 2018 was appointed director of the Institute of Politics at the Harvard Kennedy School. Guerin was the longest-serving president at HWS, but it certainly wasn't clear he would ever be coming back. Previously, Guerin's background included a stint at the Clinton White House as assistant to the president, director of communications, and director of strategic planning. He also served as director of the Peace Corps from 1995 to 1999. So what drives this change? What pushed President Jacobson to decide to leave after 3 years? And why did Mark Guerin decide to come back? How do they view the current climate on college campuses? Both have agreed to join us this hour on Connections. So welcome back to the program, outgoing HWS President Joyce Jacobson. Thanks for making time for us.
Glad to be here, Evan. Thank you for having us.
And welcome back in returning president. I guess, is the title president again already, Mark? What's the timeline here?
Yeah, well, I think so. Evan, it's great to be back on Connections, Joyce. Nice to talk to you telephonically here. But thank you very much for having both of us.
So you've already started? You start right away, Mark?
Yeah, I'm trying to transition in. Joyce has been really helpful to me to get me up to speed, and colleagues in Geneva as well. And we're finalizing things here in Boston, and I'll be heading up to campus next week and in time to greet incoming first-year students.
Well, so this is I'm going to say this is sort of a strange story in that there's very little sort of heat or even innuendo out there. Not that we report innuendo, but I mean, I don't have much of an inkling for how or why this happened. And so let me start with Joyce Jacobson and just kind of get a sense for your mindset, the decision that you made, and, you know, whether you were sort of guided to that decision, whether it all came from you, and how long this has been brewing, Joyce.
Well, I think, you know, I think, Evan, a lot of people, as we've been hopefully coming out of the pandemic, have really been rethinking, you know, are we living our best lives? And certainly a number of presidents have announced that they are stepping down. In fact, just I think another one at Eckerd College just announced 2 days ago after 2 years. So this is certainly something that has been brewing. And I think for me, as I said in the note out to the community at HWS, I was actually teaching a class again last spring, which I had not done for a long time. I'm working on a book about higher education, in particular, kind of what my co-author and I, the general counsel here, call the lawyerization of higher education. And it made me think about, you know, what is the best way I can serve and what I should be doing in the next few years. And for me, returning to my roots as a scholar and teacher really seemed like the right path right now of kind of how I can live my best life and continue to contribute to the HWS community going forward.
What were the parts of the job that were most miserable?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I think for all presidents, and certainly a lot of my friend presidents who also started the same time as I did, when we got together actually recently, we were like, is anybody having fun yet? And the answer is, you know, not really, because the pandemic has been so draining on everybody and all of the other social unrest issues that came up. I think it has just been a very difficult 3 years. Or as I like to say to people, the first 8 months were great, and then it went into 15 months of a really, really difficult period for everybody. And really continue continued challenges coming out of that, even as we struggled to get back to full normal over the last year. It certainly was a lot better, but I think also made me think more about, you know, is this really the right path for me going forward, and how could I contribute more, possibly in a different role? And certainly without Mark being willing to come back, this has made it so much easier. I think the community as a whole has been like, okay, well, great, they're both here now. And so we've really had very little, issue, I think, on the community. It's like, okay, that's fine. They know we'll work together. We're friends, and they think people trust us to manage through this, and that they can see where, you know, there's some real gains for them if I'm also here and working on a number of the projects that I set up and continuing to bring those forward.
You know, I was wondering if I was going to peel back the layers of some scandal here, but this actually sounds lacking tumult in every facet here. So, but I think there are a lot of interesting and important questions to explore with both of you. And Joyce, you just brought up, your first 8 months were, you know, really enjoyable, and then the pandemic hits, which was just a drain on everybody, and that's on every school campus, starting in pre-K all the way up through higher ed, and we can understand that. I want to ask you, and then maybe Mark can weigh in as well here, because, technically the pandemic is not over, and there are still questions about the right sort of moves to contain spread and things like that. What would you have done differently with all the knowledge you've gotten for the last couple of years? If you go back to March 2020, and this isn't meant to be a cheap kind of a question. I think the insight here is important, just because there's no way to know at the outset of a pandemic, are we going too far? Are we not going far enough? What's the right thing here? What would you have done differently now with this knowledge if you could go back there?
You know, that's a hard question, because at each stage, obviously, we're conditioning on what we knew then. And I spent a lot of time talking to the other Rochester area presidents and other presidents in New York and other places to really coordinate. I think in many ways we did a good job. I think our constituency has been happy with us. We did not have, and nobody died. Nobody was seriously ill. We managed to stay open the whole time once we were allowed to reopen in the fall of 2020. So I think in general people felt we managed it well. I think it was certainly challenging. It was very hard on the student affairs staff in particular. I don't know if I would have really done anything differently. I think some of the issues maybe around vaccines and how we managed that, maybe is slightly differently, but, you know, it was more of a timing issue than sort of when we ended up. So I feel pretty good about it. We've got a plan set up for the fall still, which I obviously worked on with our staff before that. So I feel like we are at a pretty good place, and we have managed it maybe better than some other institutions. But, you know, it's just been so many things thrown at everybody. It's partly just luck of the draw, whether you had a big breakout or not, too.
Mark, do you return to HWS with the mindset that I don't want to dismiss COVID, but I mean, are you thinking at all about COVID with any routine anymore?
Oh, absolutely. I think we have to be eternally vigilant to the complexities of variants. But, you know, my perspective, to argue back to what Joyce was just saying, is in the five years that we had left Geneva, our daughter attended and matriculated and graduated from Hobart and William Smith. So I saw this institution that I had represented it for 18 years as president through the lens of my daughter and as a parent. And I have to say, during this pandemic time, and I was exceedingly impressed with what Joyce and her team did to reopen, to the extraordinary communications to families, the vigilance of education and communication to students. None of this is easy. And I was sitting at a still in higher education here at Harvard at a university, seeing the complexities for every institution. So I come into this fall very grateful to Joyce for her leadership, particularly in this space, because it really served the institution really well. And I think that kind of cultural norm that really she established about kind of the protocols, the seriousness that it has taken, the empathy that is exhibited to special circumstances, given the very nature of this kind of pandemic. So yes, is it, of course, progress has been made, vaccinations, we know so much more, but I think we always have to be mindful of public health.
Is it your sense at all that there was too much separation at schooling at any level, Mark, or do you think the response was appropriate?
You know, I'm sort of where Joyce is. It's sort of at the level of knowledge that we knew at the time. I think people made their very best and informed judgments at the time. Sometimes it's easier with hindsight, with the benefit of new perspective and knowledge and experience to revisit some things. But I do think it has been a measured, appropriate, and keeping the North Star of the student experience very much central.
Well, Joyce, the book that you're working on, you said that it's been kind of referred to as the lawyerization of higher education. And I would love to hear more about what that phrase entails.
Well, yeah, I think our actual title is something different, like all the campus lawyers or something like that. But it's basically, you know, the sort of triple threat to institutions, the colleges and universities of higher education, of basically regulation, legislation increasingly now, not so much in this state but in others, and litigation, both the threat of it and the actual action of litigation. Is it making it hard for colleges and universities to carry out their fundamental mission? So that's the question we address in the book. We don't take a strong stance. We just say we document that this is what has happened over the last 20 years, both by looking at data, interviews with folks in the field, and our own research, and just go through all the areas in which more and more there are these external forces on colleges and universities that are making it challenging for them to operate. And, you know, we try to be positive, then also talk, here's the way strategically to deal with this world that we are now in, where there are so many expectations and forces from outside in a way that probably our predecessors, Marx and my predecessors, didn't really have to deal with. So it's practically written itself because there's just so much going on right now, as you can imagine.
What's an example of regulation that gets to be meddlesome?
Well, I think even in the state of New York, there are a lot of regulations about exactly what we can teach. I mean, we see that in other states where they are trying to regulate, for instance, whether or not you could teach certain things like, again, legislate or regulate critical race theory, issues about what accreditors you can use. It's at all levels. Title IX is kind of the big point that we take as the start of this period, what's known as the Dear Colleagues letter that came out indicating how Title IX had to be invoked and dealt with on campuses, something Mark had to deal with as well. So there are just so many areas, whether it's civil rights, free speech, even how admissions are run now, antitrust regulations that have been invoked to change colleges' behavior. And we're all waiting with, you know, bated breath to see what's going to happen this fall with the Supreme Court judgment on the Harvard case. And I think that is going to be a huge effect on how colleges do their business of selecting who attends them.
Mark, do you want to describe for listeners a little bit more about what the Supreme Court and the Harvard case is about?
Well, this is why Joyce's book is so very, very timely, and I think will be really an important contribution to the field, where the Harvard case and University of North Carolina, and it's the question of use of race in admissions, college admissions process, which, depending on where the court decides on this, could very much upend so much of higher education and where that is considered. So while Joyce's book addresses the broad issues of, as she says, the lawyerization of higher education, this subject will very much be present in the fall term's Supreme Court decision.
What outcome are you hoping for there, President Guerin?
My view is I would hope the court would maintain the current standard that Harvard and UNC and others are able to employ. But we shall see what happens.
And if they go the other way, can I ask both of you to weigh in on what you see as possible consequences? Mark first.
Well, I think the consequences are significant, and from my perspective, none of it is particularly advancing higher education and the student experience to get a well-rounded perspective in education, providing access to opportunity, all the dimensions of the attendant to the issue. So it will be a significant dimension for college admissions officers across the nation.
Okay. And Joyce, can you hit that too?
Well, similarly, I think it obviously changed the way, particularly for very selective schools, they run their admissions processes, but also probably for state systems as well. Probably for us, it will be a little less of an effect for smaller colleges like ourselves. But it's basically saying, again, in the context of my book, it is questioning the ability of colleges and universities to make their own self-governing decisions about something so key as what their actual constituted student body consists of. And that is a really strong statement that colleges and universities are not trusted to do and carry out the mission in the way they see appropriate.
Well, and you invoked, Joyce, you invoked critical race theory as something that is under sort of the lens of legislation and regulation in a number of states. And I want to talk to both of you a little bit about maybe public perception versus what's actually being taught or what's really going on here. One of the people who has been the most influential in this country in framing how the public sees CRT is a conservative activist named Christopher Rufo, who works for the American Enterprise Institute. And he made explicit, I mean, this was not sort of under the radar, he made it explicit that he wanted all Americans to hear CRT and have a negative view. He wanted to tie any teaching on race to CRT, starting K to 12 all the way to the higher ed level. And he wanted to kind of shut down CRT as a viable idea. And he feels like in at least a lot of states, he's been pretty successful. And in the last week, he essentially announced publicly that his next target is gender studies. And that, you know, he aims to call it something along the lines of, you know, extreme gender ideology, similar to CRT. He wants the public to hear it that way. And he thinks the public will be hearing a lot more about that. He thinks it will be effective. This is a guy with a lot of sway. I mean, he's got Donald Trump's ear. He has the ear of just about every conservative commentator, many members of Congress. And we see his work show up in legislation in more than 20 states, and in various forms of litigation, and as Joyce said, in probably in forms of regulation. So there's a lot to discuss here. Let's start with CRT. Joyce, what do you think the public hears with CRT, and what do you think the reality on campuses like HWS is with that?
Well, I think, you know, there are many people on this campus that discuss race and ethnicity issues from a number of different lenses. I would think there are very few people who say, I have a very pure version of CRT through which I'm seeing the world. But I do think for our students, the idea that, again, any external force saying we can't teach things in a certain way or you can't talk about these things is just, again, an enormous burden on college and universities to have to deal with that kind of external force. Again, unlikely to happen in New York State, but we see it happening already in other states like Idaho. And again, it's crazy to think that legislatures will be telling colleges and universities, whether public or private, what they can or cannot teach their students.
Okay. Do you see CRT, you know, routinely showing up in curriculum these days?
I would say that, again, a nuanced, you know, liberal arts view is we're taking a number of different lenses for looking at issues. I don't think, for instance, anybody on this campus specifically says, I am like a peer CRT advocate or theorist. They would think about it as, again, there are different ways to look at what's going on. And one of the things we would hope to do in colleges is apprise students of the different approaches that people take to issues and let them see how those play out differently. Now, that may not play out in reality in all cases, but that's certainly the ideal that we see for college and universities to be able to air a number of views and let students actually see how they contrast.
How do you define, Joyce, what CRT is?
I personally, not being somebody who knows that much about it as something I've studied deeply, I would say that one of the problems is whenever you start using terms like that, mm-hmm. it becomes something that doesn't actually align with any one individual's work or writings or teachings. It just becomes a catchphrase, and I think you're making that clear also in talking about this guy, that it becomes sort of devoid of value because it just becomes a catchphrase, and it's not really a theory or a way of thinking about things that anybody is following. Just as like calling people a Marxist is just so reductive of what people who study Marx and his writings or modern Marxism actually would do.
I think that's actually fair, and so I want to reframe it then, because I don't think it's fair to ask you to define it. I mean, it, maybe the Kimberly Crenshaws of the world could do that, but that's not probably fair to you. So I'll ask you a different way. When you hear CRT, how does it hit your ear? What does it invoke in your mind?
That's a good question. I mean, I do think it says it's turning a critical lens to some questions that maybe people weren't considering thoroughly. And to the degree that that can be very eye-opening to students, I think that's something that you wouldn't want to repress. I think the gender theory, that's really my area of study. The idea that, again, there would be some strictures on how we discuss gender in the environs of higher ed is, again, very troubling. I know people may be worried about how it's acting out for people nowadays. But again, to repress any kind of discussion or way of thinking about things, again, just seems so antithetical to how colleges and universities should be able to operate in a free society.
We'll return to gender in a second. President Guerin, how does CRT hit your ears?
Well, it has hit my ears, frankly, from my current position in the past year at the Institute of Politics at the Kennedy School in the political context, seeing it in the Virginia gubernatorial race initially and winding its way into school board elections, where it becomes a bit more of a bumper sticker phrase in the depth of exposition of what it's actually about. And it's been interesting to me to see the political dimensions of this, how each party is handling it, the kind of responsiveness to it. But your broader point, whether it's in gender studies, whether it's in critical race issues, of how it needs to, we need to be cautious as a citizenry of advocacy, how it is shortened into a shortened phrase, and then people are bringing their own kind of perspective to it. And leveling that with, as Joyce has said, kind of the reality of what's happening in classrooms.
So on the subject then of gender, you said, Joyce, that's more your realm here. Gender studies in general, how have you seen that change in your career? And do you think it's in a productive and healthy place?
You know, it has really changed a lot over the course of my career. And I think one thing is earlier on, it was often called women's studies. At HWS, we actually had men's studies also. I think there is a movement now towards a larger tent, whether it's feminist gender and sexuality studies or some broader characterization of the area of interdisciplinary research and teaching. So it has really changed. I think the many issues right now in this country about how transgender persons and non-binary persons are being treated is just a fascinating area. We've seen it changing so rapidly right now, and that's exactly the kind of area we should be thinking about and working on and working with our students on campuses, because it is so pertinent to their lives and it's changing so rapidly.
Have there been an increase in the number of either student complaints or concerns about discrimination in regards to gender? I ask because there was a study in Pittsburgh and some pediatricians there talking about how in a number of Pittsburgh area high schools, it used to be that less than 1% of students would self-identify as, not the gender they were assigned at birth. And now it's along the lines of 9 to 10%. And that's an explosion in the number. And I wonder what that means on college campuses. Does that mean more sensitivity, different approaches to teaching? Or have you had more complaints or concern about discrimination? Can you describe some of that, Joyce?
Sure. I don't think, it's interesting, as you mentioned, it's happening right now in these younger grades. It hasn't fully hit the colleges yet. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's certainly been coming along, but this sort of recent wave is kind of starting with the kids who are in middle school right now. And I have said, for instance, to our dean of admissions, in 6 years, this is going to be a huge issue for colleges. And I think for us, because we have this coordinate structure still, it is an issue for us because we have this binary structure, the way that Hobart and Wayne Smith is set up. So that's certainly something I've been thinking a lot about. I would say we have not really had issues on campus too much. I think college campuses in general have been welcoming places for students who are questioning or evolving or redefining their sexuality and their gender, and that we have been, that this college in particular has been supportive of that. So I would say that has not been a big issue for us on campuses, but there's certainly areas like switching to using non-binary bathrooms as much as possible where we are having to redesign and rethink areas of campus and how we provide services.
Yeah, it's interesting you say it hasn't necessarily hit in the same numbers at HWS, but you're right. I mean, there is sort of this bifurcated frame that the public has of HWS. You have Hobart for the men, William Smith College for the girls. And if applicants in the future or in the present right now are self-identify as non-binary or gender fluid, not a man, not a woman, do you direct them to either school, or are either school prepared for that?
Yes, we've certainly said that students are free to identify with either or feel like they're just identifying with the joint entity of HWS. We now have a choice, for instance, that they can choose their diplomas. For instance, for people who are male identifying, they can either pick Hobart College or Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Same for those who are female identifying, and we don't require people to identify. So there are sort of those ways that we are dealing with it internally, but I do think we are providing still a weirdly binary structure to the rest of the world that I think we are going to have to be very thoughtful about going forward. And certainly we've changed some things since I've been here, and before I was here it was starting to change through student pressure to some degree about making sure that we are seen as completely welcoming to students who do not stand with the normal binary.
Yeah, and one more question on this thread, and then I'll ask President Guerin, and then I'm sure both of our guests will be happy to talk about many other things. But Joyce, yesterday in Dallas, speaking to conservatives, Hungarian leader Viktor Orban was there. And the biggest cheer he got, and he got many, but the biggest cheer he got was in his declaration about why Hungary does not, why his administration in Hungary does not recognize equal marriage, gay rights, and his invocation of as there are only men and only women, and you know that he essentially rejects gender fluidity. He brought the house down. Huge cheers in Dallas at the conservative conference there. What do you think the culture war split is really about here? And I ask that sort of sincerely. I'm not like trying to provoke anything other than I'm very curious to know what you think. Why you think this has become such an explosive issue in terms of the culture wars right now?
Well, I do think, I mean, the rate of change, of social change, has been enormous lately. And a lot of it has related to gender roles. And so certainly people who tend, whether psychologically and or politically, to the conservative, there's been a lot of stressors on those folks. We had Brett Stevens came and talked last spring, wonderful talk, really talked about kind of classical conservatism and the idea that, you know, culture should move at a relatively slow pace of change. And culture has been moving really quickly lately, and it's very tied in, as Mark could talk about also, with the political and legislative and judicial structures that are going on. So I can see where a lot of people find, you know, this is not how I grew up. This is not what I'm used to. And frankly, I need some more time to think about what's going on. It's just going too fast for me.
Is it too fast, though? I mean, I take Brett's point, and that is, I think what Brett Stevens is saying there is exactly what Tom Nichols and many others say, which is that conservatism is just that. It's not total resistance to change. It's sort of slow adoption of change, honoring a lot of tradition, et cetera. Is it, in your view, is the culture moving too fast, Joyce?
Well, I think with the issues about gender and young children, I think that is giving a lot of people pause in particular. And again, just thinking, are we doing the right thing by children when they are questioning their sexuality and their gender? How do we work with these young people? And I don't think we know completely how to do that yet. The studies are in their infancy on this. And so it is an area where things seem to be moving very quickly. And I think that is giving a lot of people pause. And they're seeing it happening in their lives, in their children's lives, in the friends of their children. And it's coming to a lot of areas and moving very quickly. So I think it's fascinating to watch as a phenomenon, but if you're involved in it, again, this can be very quick.
Mark Guerin, as the returning president of HWS, how do you see this issue impacting campus?
Well, you know, obviously I'm still learning a lot about today's Hobart and William Smith, and I've been really struck by the innovations of the past few years, particularly under Joyce's leadership. I wrote a letter to campus upon my appointment, and I was reminded of the E.B. White essay, Once More to the Lake, right, where he writes about going back to a lake in Maine that he had visited as a boy, and this time with his son. And then a lot of it is about his own mortality and so forth, but he also writes about the constancy of the lake. And in many ways, for me, returning once more to the lake, to channel E.B. White, has resonance, because while the lake is constant, in this case Seneca Lake and the beautiful Finger Lakes, so much has changed in our society since 2017 when I left the shores of Seneca Lake, in our polity, in our from the pandemic to racial reckoning to greater understanding of mental health awareness issues, to the very challenges to our democracy. So going back to 2017 seems a very different time, A, in terms of the global societal civic issues. And then for Hobart and William Smith, there's been a lot of very significant innovative changes. And I guess that's what most excites me, A, to work with Joyce. I'm grateful she's returning to the faculty. She's herself a distinguished scholar, and her new book evidences that, and her teaching excellence. So we're very, very fortunate. An alum said to me, "This is great. There's two presidents on campus." I said, "Okay, this is good. I like that. I need." Well, and fortunately, Joyce and I have worked together. She was kind to ask me to this past year's reunion, and we've kept in touch as a colleague, but also when our daughter was there. So I go into this really with excitement to relearn today's Hobart and William Smith, mindful of all the societal changes that I reference, grateful for the innovations on campus. But then finally, I would say, Evan, that, you know, one of the things I always loved about Hobart and William Smith was the kind of lean to innovation and the lean to difference. One of the great histories of Hobart and William Smith by Warren Hunting Smith described it as a feeling of panache on campus, which was always, I thought, a very interesting word, panache. But from that, I take kind of the innovations and the ability and confidence to change the very foundational structure of a women's college in 1908, the kind of innovations in curriculum from Western civilization to changing that, to thinking through how do you kind of craft a modern student experience. So that those traditions certainly remain in the very ecosystem of Hobart and William Smith. So to a lot of these issues, A, I have my own learning curve to, as I said, relearn today's Hobart and William Smith, but also knowing how much higher education has changed. I think whether I was sitting at Hobart and William Smith or sitting here at Harvard, the landscape of higher education has changed significantly. We've learned a lot during this pandemic, some things constructively, many things concerning in terms of learning loss, in terms of acquisition of knowledge, and so forth. So, but I'm appreciative of what has happened. I'm excited to try to understand it better and then to work with the really extraordinary faculty and staff that we have there with very dedicated alums to move it forward.
Talking to Mark Guerin, the returning president of Hobart and William Smith Colleges, and Joyce Jacobson, the outgoing president. If you're just joining us, it was a surprise to a lot of people recently when the announcement came that Joyce Jacobson would be stepping down as HWS president. She's been there in that role since 2019. She will continue to teach and work on her book and stay in higher ed. And Mark Guerin, who served for 18 years as president of HWS before leaving for Harvard in 2017, is coming back. And they are both with us. This is our only break of the hour, and we're right back to some of your questions as well for the presidents, we'll say, next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about George Jetson's birthday. According to the show that debuted in the 1960s, The Jetsons, George's birthday was July 31st, 2022. That was this past Sunday. What did they think the future would look like? How close did they get it? And what do we think the future might look like 60, 100 years in the future? We'll talk about it next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I wanted to ask one more question on the subject of sort of the campus climate right now. And there's a lot of talk about free expression on campus. There's a lot of talk about openness to different ideas. And was reading recently some of the work of Greg Lukianoff and some of his colleagues at FIRE, which is the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. And Greg writes that FIRE continues to, quote, challenge free speech zones on college campuses, claiming they are unconstitutional restrictions on First Amendment rights. Our organization has provided legal support to students contesting free speech zones while also supporting legislation to eliminate such zones. Free expression continues to be a problem on many college campuses, end quote. Joyce Jacobson, do you agree with that? Is free speech sometimes too restricted or an issue on college campuses?
I do think it is a challenge to have people feel sufficiently empowered that they feel they can speak without significant repercussion. I think social media has made this challenging for many professors. We've seen a lot of examples where a professor may have said something in a class that they thought was in a safe space for them and then found it out on social media with a bunch of people they didn't know writing them and complaining about it. We do not have any kind of free speech zones or things like that on campus here. I think it's also interesting that FIRE has recently changed their name, where they used to focus on only institutes of higher education, and they have broadened it out. And I think that is partly because they have really not been that effective in the higher education zone. I mean, I myself and probably Mark have received letters from them, which have kind of nagged about various things, but you know, they don't really have any legal standing to change anything that we're doing, nor was there anything that needed to be changed in what we're doing. So I've been fascinated by the organization, but I also think they have not been as effective as they may have wished they had been.
And I think if I'm going to characterize some of what they do, it is not just limited to so-called policing of speech or policing of free speech zones, et cetera, in any one political direction, although there is some consistent concern that campus conservatives are sort of limited or kind of drowned out or shouted down, et cetera. Do you see that, Joyce?
Yeah, I do think it's coming from more of a concern that conservative voices are underheard. And certainly reflected that we know that the professoriate is overwhelmingly liberal on most campuses. We know that they tend to vote Democratic rather than Republican. So it is true that there is that aspect of the demography. It's not as obvious that the students are that way, though. And if anything, research shows that students are less likely to be influenced in their political stance by what happens on their campuses, that they come actually fairly preformed from their family and their friend background, and that we are really not influencing that in any kind of negative way, but really just trying to open them up to a broader range of thought, but not brainwashing them into any particular way of thinking.
Mark Guerin, any concern that the vast majority of professors tend to be liberal?
Well, I tend to look at this as it is interesting, because what I would be concerned most about on any campus if conservative students themselves felt that they could not give voice to their opinion or question in a class comfortably or have the kind of, and indeed here at Harvard, as Joyce said, like many institutions, both the student body, the faculty are probably overwhelmingly more progressive than not. And one of the things that we worked on here at the Institute of Politics is to create a conservative coalition to ensure the kind of voices. It's by bringing speakers in, by bringing guests in, and engaging in the conversations. When I was here, like Joyce, as an undergraduate, and my college roommate was the president of the Republican Club. He's now a conservative talk show host and columnist. But our friendship has endured since we were undergraduates. But at the time, it was rather uneventful that the president of the Republican Club, and I was obviously not a Republican, were roommates and close friends. That would be less obvious today, I am sorry to say. And so the question is, what can we do as campus leadership, in campus leadership roles, to kind of forge the kind of conversations that are good for both conservative and progressive students, to challenge everyone's ideas respectfully in ways that can be a learning environment that's really consequential. So I think it requires it. Hobart and William Smith, Joyce, was successful in establishing a forum, Stern Family Forum, that she referenced. Brett Stevens attended last year. This year, the conversation will be with former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, in conversation with the Democratic strategist James Carville. And Hobart alumnus and CBS correspondent Bill Whitaker will moderate it. So it's an example, I think, of what Hobart and William Smith is trying to engage ideas in and around substantive issues with substantive people, to question them, to have that kind of free-flowing conversation in ways that can be very much helpful to both conservative and progressive students.
Let me read an email from a listener named Joseph, who says, I'm a Hobart alum, and I'm extremely grateful for my time there. I can genuinely say that I could not have gotten a better education at any other school. During my time at HWS, there seemed to be a commendable effort to have the colleges and the students be involved with the wider Geneva community and to try to bring down some of the town and gown barrier. However, I think it's fair to say that many schools are part of a larger drug economy or whatever town or city they are part of. And in the future, what do both of your guests see as the role of colleges in addressing problems in the wider Geneva community, particularly when it comes to things like illegal drugs? That comes from Joseph. Joyce Jacobson, you want to start? What do you think?
Sure. You know, it's interesting right now because, of course, we are subject to federal regulations. So even though pot is now legal in New York, we still restrict on campus. So we are still subject to the federal restrictions, which I think, you know, is a big issue as we think about how the state and federal law get out of step. I think we have, and this is so true under Mark and his wife Mary's time, we have really developed very close ties with the city. We certainly work on many issues with them. We are very active with the Boys and Girls Clubs, with a number of other community organizations. And so I think for our students, it's very important they get immersed in the local community. We have a number of them embedded in the school system also with our MAT program. And we just continue to try to make sure that they understand what the problems are of a small town like Geneva, about 13,000, but, you know, some serious issues in a town like this, including a lot of hunger issues right now and access to resources. And so I think we will just continue that work jointly. And again, thank you so much, Joseph, for those kind comments about your institution that we all love.
Mark Yearn, what would you say to that?
No, well, I join with Joyce, certainly, in thanking Joseph for the nice question. And that's exactly the kind of alum who have had the privilege of hearing that how they're experience in Geneva was really transformative. And a big part of it, I think, for so many of our students is that engagement with the community. It is both the right thing to do as a community partner, institutional partner. We sit many ways on lovely real estate. We engage with the community. And I think evidencing that sense of citizenship is really core to a liberal arts and sciences education that a place like Hobart and William Smith provide. So I think it's the right thing to do by the community, but it's also the thing it's the right thing to do by our students. They will graduate and go on to, as our mission says, to lead a life of consequence, right? That's what we aspire for all our graduates. And whether they're in a smaller city like Geneva or a larger one like Manhattan, their responsibility to public purpose, their responsibility to their fellow citizens is something hopefully that they will reach back over the arc of their lives and careers and think of their time in upstate New York and in this community. Because as Joyce rightly points out, so many of the issues that play out nationally are very much present in a smaller scale, but as significant in Geneva. So with our faculty scholarship, with our engagement with our staff, and with a sense of community service and volunteerism with our students, partnering with the Boys and Girls Club and others, we can make a difference in the lives of students. So it is, I think, threaded to what we aspire for our graduates, that they would graduate like Joseph did with that sense of community and hopefully take that to their future communities as whether that's within their profession, their family lives, or residentially.
And there's a phrase you brought up there that is part of the HWS mission, creating a life of consequence. And Mark, I want to follow up on this point because I'm thinking about what Joyce said earlier this hour, which is that sometimes there is there's sort of this burgeoning view on the political right that college campuses are all about indoctrination or brainwashing, as opposed to trying to create a venue in which the graduates can lead lives of consequence, but that doesn't always mean the same thing. And you know, I'm thinking about the attacks on higher ed from that are pretty cynical, from people like J.D. Vance, who's running for Senate in the state of Ohio, who has just been hammering higher ed, despite the fact that he went to not only Ohio State, but Yale, and, you know, is a venture capital guy who is attacking the elites, which is I find fascinating. But it is working for the moment for him. I find that very cynical. But then I think of just, you know, sort of rank and file voters everywhere, and especially voters in rural America who may have some either cynicism or skepticism of college campuses and may share that view that, well, when Marx has a life of consequence, it means one thing and they're going to try to mold this person in exactly this direction. So, Mark, how do you create a college campus that allows free expression, the kind of learning that allows people to go on to lead lives of consequence, but that doesn't necessarily mean exactly what Mark Guerin or Joyce Jacobson or only one person says?
And of course it doesn't. And that's, I think, the power of the Hobart and William Smith mission, is that you have, it's a highly individualized conclusion as to what a life of consequence is. But what happens during four falls and four springs in Geneva, New York, is transformative for our students by what they absorb in the classroom and their engagement with our extraordinary faculty, or outside the classroom in athletics, to in sports, club sports, to activities, and in the community of Geneva, and augmented with a real lean on global education as well. So all of this gets to me, for a place like Hobart and William Smith, as a relationship-rich education. What happens there is the kind of relationships our students have with their faculty members, coaches, staff members, a volunteer in the community lunch program that they get to know. Those relationships are and have been defining. So, you know, perhaps higher education hasn't done itself really any justice by not taking on some of these critiques in a more affirmative way. I would observe, and Vance is one example you have given, and others politically are cited, but many have come through some of the elite institutions in our society that are frequently the targets, right? And they've gone on to form their own views, however you may hear and come to them, right? And that is really the free and open inquiry of a liberal education, liberal in that sense of kind of liberal arts and sciences education. So I think we need to be more affirmative on that into what this is and what it isn't. This is what the definition is and has been at a place like Hobart and William Smith, so that you graduate. A few years ago when I was there, there were two members of the United States Congress who were graduates of Hobart and William Smith. One was a Republican, one was a Democrat. That pattern you see politically across the landscape of our graduates, appropriately so. But I think all of them share a sense to public purpose and to lead a life of consequence, whether that's in public service, whether that's in the private sector or the not-for-profit sector. That is their decision. That is how they channel the benefits of their education in their own aspirations and interests, and how that works for them as an individual and with their family.
Joyce, you want to hit that point too?
Well, I think just the incredible spread of the fields in which our alums have gone on to be successful speaks to the variety of ways in which one can lead a life of consequence. So Mark mentioned, of course, across the political spectrum, but, you know, we've got Ali Marpet, we've got people like John Grotzinger and NASA, and, you know, just the idea that you can be successful in so many areas. And that's one of the things I really liked about the school, is that we have such a range of fields in which people have made a mark. And I think that speaks well, as opposed to being a school that's known for just engineers or just business. It's across the range. And that says, again, people are allowed to define their own way of thinking about what it means to have a consequential life.
Question from a listener named David via email, and I'll pose this one to the incoming president, not the outgoing, because Joyce now gets to have a little bit more autonomy on her time. David says, I've heard that a college president's role has shifted heavily to fundraising. Is that affecting the attraction of potential college presidential candidates? Mark Guerin, a lot of time fundraising?
You know, I think modern presidencies now for some time have understood that the role to kind of achieve the aspirations, particularly for private education, is to secure the resources. I really have found it's a very frequent question, candidly, with friends and others. Do you have to spend all your time? I think it really is, in many ways, advocacy for the institution that you have a unique seat at and understanding, to advocate for the kind of physical spaces, financial aid assistance, scholarships that really is really, I think, with pride, one is able to articulate and to find the right match. So fortunately, Hobart and William Smith has a really dedicated group of alumni and alumni around the world. And under Joyce's leadership the past few years, has had significant support financially for the institution. That says a lot about the institution, says a lot about the leadership, certainly. But at its core, people are grateful. People are grateful for the experience they had, grateful for the kind of relationship-rich education they enjoyed, and how, like your earlier questioner, how that informs them in their lives. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you know, it is certainly a part of a portfolio, but it's with pride you get to represent a place like Hobart and William Smith.
Is it like the cliche about members of Congress that half your time is spent fundraising now?
I don't think so. I don't.
Not quite,
you know,
that much.
I would find it much harder to. Their challenge is it's very personal. It's raising for them.
Yeah.
This is for an idea. This is for a financial aid, providing a ladder of opportunity to an individual or physical space that will transform. Those are big ideas that are worth advocating for.
And Joyce Jacobson, as you exit as role of president, can I just ask you real quick as we get ready to wrap here, when's your book due out, and will you come back and talk about it?
Well, that would be great. So our book, we're supposed to actually deliver our manuscript on August 15th, so pretty soon, but probably the book won't come out till next year given the publishing lags that we now experience.
I've been under those deadlines before. Get off the radio and get back to work.
Right.
Joyce Jacobson is the outgoing president of HWS and still an important part of the HWS community, teaching and writing. And you have always been generous with your time with this program, and I do hope you'll come back and talk about the book. Thank you, Joyce.
Thank you.
Mark Guerin returning as president to HWS. Mark, welcome back to this program, and I know we'll talk again soon.
Look forward to it, Evan. Thanks so much.
Thanks to Mark and Joyce this hour. And more connections coming up in just a moment.